beginning to read at the 17th chapter, starting at the first verse and reading through to the seventh verse. The Israelites have left Egypt. The Egyptian armies under Pharaoh have drowned in the Red Sea. And now the children of Israel face another hazard, and that is the vicissitudes of a wilderness and desert life. Preceding our text, and let me contextualize it, the people were in need of water. They complained bitterly to Moses because they were dying of thirst, or so they felt. And so Moses kind of took a branch of a tree. God said, do that and throw it in the water, because the water, I guess, was poisonous. And suddenly the water was fit to drink and it was sweet to taste. So God took care of that need right away. And then in the 16th chapter, the people are hungry. And so they complain bitterly to Moses once again, and God provides immediately manna, which is, it's described as a bread that tastes like coriander and honey. But the Hebrew word for manna means, what is it? Manna is essentially, what is it? The people don't know what it is, but they have it. And they also say, look, we want meat as well. And this is a kind of a leitmotif through Exodus. We don't have meat, and we long for the McDonald's of Egypt and the flesh pots of Egypt and all of that, which they never had, by the way. They were indulging in nostalgic and fabricated and confabulated thinking when they thought about their past in Egypt. They had no such thing, but they long for meat, so God provides them quails as well as manna. So you have a little bread here and you have a little meat here and all is set. But as they journey on, if they have need, they want it met immediately. And here is another occasion where they are out of water and they are worried about perishing. And Moses complains to God, and God answers the need and provides water. Nevertheless, what we see once again is contention and a triangulation between God, Moses, and the people he leads. And what does that say about our lives, particularly as Christian leaders, whether it's in our families, fellowship communities? How are we called to lead and understand perhaps the people we lead? With that introduction, hear God's word to us. The whole Israelite community set out from the desert, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded. They camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. So they quarreled with Moses and said, give us water to drink. And Moses replied, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test? But the people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses. They said, why did you bring us up out of Egypt, that land of plenty, to make us and our children live and die of thirst? Then Moses cried out to the Lord, what am I to do with these people? They are almost ready to stone me. The Lord answered Moses, walk on ahead of the people, take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff from which you struck the Nile years ago, and go. I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb, which is another word for Mount Sinai. Strike that rock, and water will come out of it for the people to drink. So Moses did this in the presence of the people, and in the sight of the elders of Israel. And he called the place Massah and the place Meribah, because the Israelites quarreled and because they tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or is the Lord not? This is the word of the Lord. I am sure that none of you have been literally stoned lately. And I'm not talking about the kind of stoned, that word as it was applied in the late 60s and early 70s, of which you may have or may not have some, intellectual experience of. But I think when I talk about stoning, I'm talking about what happened to the good people of Israel. It became a Levitical law that if someone was blaspheming against God, well, that person deserved to be stoned to death. And in the New Testament, we have Jesus, who protects a woman who's been ostensibly caught in adultery, and the gentlemen are all lifting stones, and they're going to stone her to death until Jesus says, he or she who is without sin cast the first stone. But I think in many ways we have been stoned metaphorically. I think Moses' fear is a fear that I think we can embrace and relate. Because often it seems there are naysayers and gainsayers in our midst who want to do us harm, if not physically, then indeed emotionally. And we often ask ourselves, why are people against us? Why do people want to stone us? And sometimes the answer is because we've messed up, and maybe they have a right. But often there are other psychological factors going on, and especially when we look at ourselves and say, I am innocent of whatever the stone throwers want to throw stones at me for. I am not guilty. So what gives? And I think as we look at our text, we understand what gives. That the children of Israel are mad at God. And they ask the question, is God for us or against us? Is God with us? And in lieu of having an auditory answer from the Almighty, they take it out on Moses. They're going to stone Moses. The issue then is not between God and the people, but Moses becomes the scapegoat. Moses becomes the scapegoat because, indeed, he's an easy target. Have you ever been a scapegoat? I bet you have. I bet you have. Oh, when you divorce, you know? When you divorce, who do you blame? Well, it's not me. And it may not even be your spouse you're divorcing. But it was my parental upbringing that caused this. My parents are all, or my grandparents, they caused it. They were the scapegoat. And often, you know what I find too with divorcing parents with children. And I'm saying that, you know, sometimes there are clear and defined causes for divorce, but sometimes the parent who is truly negligent, maybe that parent leaves home or has been abusive and then leaves home. And the parent who sticks around for the sake of the children, the parent who does his or her best for the sake of the children, when those children become a certain age, who do they blame? They blame the caregiver. They blame the parent who has been the most loving. They blame the parent who is there for them. And why do they do that? Because it's safer. It's safer than blaming the negligent, the malfeasant parent who is nowhere around. Or if they could blame the parent because the parent is around, they're afraid of the consequences. So often we become a scapegoat in the best sense of the word, because although it is not our fault, the people who have been hurt need to blame someone. They need to attack someone. And so they attack you. And in many ways, that's Christ-like behavior. Because the world was quite angry. And so they took an innocent man and strung him up on the cross, and they hated him. Yeah, that story about Frank Booth, who was the great Shakespearean actor, who was John Wilkes Booth's brother. Shortly after he assassinated President Lincoln, his brother went on stage, I think it was either Boston or New York, and at that time in the 19th century, you didn't get applause afterwards, but the characters in the drama would come out before the play began and would take their bows. Speaking of narcissism, or speaking of self-confidence, they'd take their bows in the beginning. Well, people were ready for a thespian Booth. When he came out to take his bows, everyone had fruits, and vegetables and whatever they could throw at him. Because he was the scapegoat for his brother who had killed the president on Good Friday. He was the scapegoat. And they threw everything at him until the whole stage was littered with junk. And he just stood his place. And then he looked around and said, "Okay, are you done? Let the play begin." And when he said that, they all stood up and applauded. So, you know, even if you're a scapegoat, take it like a woman or like a man, because indeed you may be following Christ's way and understanding of what you should be about. You know, you may be a scapegoat for your manager. You may be working as hard as you possibly can, and your manager nevertheless is out seemingly to hurt you, to destroy you, to screw you up, whatever. You're his scapegoat. And why is that? Because the manager is afraid of confronting his boss. That happens. You may be a scapegoat between two people who are fighting. You know, and those two, the people who are fighting may say to you, "Can you solve our problem?" And you, being the doobie, the good doobie, says, "Of course I can solve your problem. All you two have to do is this, that, and or the other thing, and your problem will be solved." And what do? The two people said, "You know, we don't hate each other. We hate you. You're the problem." And that's true, and that's biblical. You know, Pontius Pilate was an enemy of Herod Antipas, who was the governor up in Galilee. He was part Jewish, and Pontius Pilate knew nothing about the Jews except he disliked them intensely. He was the Roman governor there. When Jesus is crucified, we are told in the Gospel of Luke that suddenly Pontius Pilate and Herod Antipas become bosom buddies. So Jesus becomes a scapegoat. Are you a scapegoat? Are you a scapegoat? Well, to be a leader, I think sometimes you have to say, "I accept that role. I accept that role. It may be unfair, but I will do it if it causes reconciliation or if it helps someone who's been hurt relieve that sense of hurt." So, Moses was not a good leader, I think, because he was not a good scapegoat. He didn't accept that responsibility. The second thing I'd like to say about our text is that in order to be a good leader, we have to understand why people do what they do. Even in seminary, I was taught, you know, the children of Israel are children. They beg, they whine, they complain throughout their wilderness journey. But, you know, I wonder whether we would have done the same thing if we had been enslaved. If our parents had been enslaved, if our grandparents had been enslaved, if we, along with our parents and grandparents, had been starved, if we had witnessed, as Pharaoh did, the genocidal actions of killing the firstborn of all the Israelite males, how would that have affected us psychologically? Would not we have reacted in the same way? This is what I find. People who have been liberated from Pharaoh, whether it's a terrible childhood situation, whether it's a terrible vocational situation, whether it's a terrible romantic situation, whatever, people who are liberated seem not to be able to delay gratification. They want it now. I want my manna now. I want my quails now. I want my water now. I need it right now, because if I don't have it, I'm going to die. And if I don't have it, it reminds me, it re-traumatizes me about the fact that I didn't have it under slavery. That's what's so frightening. And it seems to me that we have to understand. Now, you know, some people we deal with are whiners. Some people we deal with do complain, and they have no right to complain. One of my mentors at New Brunswick Seminary, the president, who had been a preacher for most of his life, had a student who came to him, and he was a straight-A student. But he got a B-plus in one course, which subverted his straight-A thing. And he went to the president, and he was, "You know, I just got a B-plus in this, and, you know, and he said, what should I do?" And my friend, the president, said, "What I want you to do is take a real big tack and sit on it." I want you to take a real big tack and sit on it. Because in a world such as ours, you have no right to complain. In a world with the separating needs that we say, you have no right to talk about whether you're getting an A or an A minus or a B plus. God doesn't care. Howard said, I don't care, and you better not care if you're going to be a minister, and not even a minister, if you're going to be a servant of Jesus Christ. That's unimportant. That's unimportant. So I think, you know, sometimes we have to look at people before we label them as whiners or complainers or, you know, we don't want to ever invite them to a cocktail hour or anything like that. You know, we have to look behind the surface and see what's going on. Have they escaped a pharaonic situation? You know, often children are said, you know, this child is bad. This child always wants things immediately. Just like the children wants things immediately, we'll take it out of other children's hands. That child is no good, bad seed. Child may have ADHD. That child may have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which children, as a therapist, often goes undiagnosed. Often goes undiagnosed. And yet we're not willing to say, let's see what's behind this aberrant or negative behavior. Let's see what's behind it before we label that child in some way that's not healthy. A label which sticks with that child throughout his or her life. Let's have some compassion and see why the whining is happening. Has that child been enslaved in any way as the children of Israel were enslaved? Or we say about that adult, my goodness, what an awful person this person is. Takes all of his or her money and bets it on the horses. How irresponsible. What a sinful life this person has lived. Well, could be the case. Could be the case. But supposing that person has undiagnosed bipolar manic depressive disorder, and when that person is in his or her manic stage, he or she is willing to sell the farm. And it may seem as if the person is being cruel. That person may be someone that we think is despicable, but that someone simply needs a lot of lithium, escalith, along with some caring and compassionate people in order to get well. How quick we are to label and to call people whiners and complainers and everything else. Sometimes people are. And certainly we live in a society which feels they're entitled to anything. Notice, as Christians, we have a lot of work to do in our society where everyone feels entitled and they're going to complain about everything. And, so I think that is an evil which we need to address. Christians need to address. But nevertheless, as compassionate folks, I think we need to look behind behavior which is not good to see what the root cause might be. And it might not be sin. It might be something else, a mental health issue, an emotional issue caused by bondage under Pharaoh, whatever that word Pharaoh means. The final thing I'd like to say about our text is this, that Moses is always ready to respond to the people's needs. And God does, out of love and mercy, respond to the people's needs. Wonderfully and brilliantly. But you know, I ask this question to each one of us. If God answered every prayer you asked, if God answered and gave you whatever you needed in the moment you asked it, would you believe in God? Would you have greater faith? Would you run around hurley saying, I believe? And unlike Peter, say, help thou my unbelief. We wouldn't say that, I believe. Or would you begin to take God's mercy and grace for granted? Because that's what the story of Exodus is about. The people ask for water, God gives it to them. The people ask for food, God gives them manna and quails in abundance. The people ask for whatever, and God gives it to them. and in Exodus 32, they've been reassured more than once, 100 times, that God is a God who provides for our needs. In Exodus 32, what do? They create a golden calf. While Moses is climbing up Mount Sinai to get the Ten Commandments, they create a golden calf. My fear for all of us is that if God were to answer any prayer we had immediately, we'd forget about God. And like most of society, especially in the Northeast, we wouldn't even think of God. We'd kind of attribute our success to our success. God doesn't matter. Meist Eckhart, who's the great theologian I did doctoral work on, the great Meist Eckhart, who lived between 1260 and 1328, could say, you know what people do with God? They treat God like a cow. They milk God, get the milk they want, and then throw the cow away. That's what I think would happen. So I guess, you know, Philippians and Paul says, my God will provide your every need. You don't have to worry. My God will provide for your every need. But thank God for unanswered prayer. Thank God for stretches in your life where God doesn't seem real and palpable in your life. Thank God for those moments when everything you pray for is not answered, because everything you pray for may not be good not only for God, but may not be good for you. Thank God for unanswered prayer. Thank God that God loves us enough to kind of say, okay, son, okay, daughter, I need to move away a little bit, because as Paul says in Philippians, I want you, son, daughter, to work out your salvation with fear and trembling. That's what we're called to do. And that's how we're called to live. May we do so with the courage and strength of Jesus Christ this day. Thanks be to God. Amen. You may greet one another this morning saying, the peace of Christ be with you.